Hello and welcome to Journeys of Max Up podcast. Today I'm here with Dr. Ivan Hurd, who is Assistant Professor of Piano Pedagogy and Coordinator of Class Piano at the UTSA School of Music. He's also teaches piano privately here at Maxa. I'm delighted to have him here today. Welcome, Ivan.
Thank you. Thanks for having me.
Awesome. So glad to have you. Well, I wanted to mention a few things about some of your articles, things you've been doing in the past few years. I looked through your bio, and it was so long, I had to kind of reduce everything down. You've been a busy person, and I've seen you at a lot of conferences presenting these things, and you always get a ton of people there, as well as read your articles. So you've done things on preparation for Debussy, things on Impressionism, on the Russian composer Rebikov, on technique from opposite perspectives, which is a really fun one with Dr. Keeling, one on ornamentation, a bunch of things with the J.K. Hodges competition here in San Antonio, something on musicality and song original song lyrics, memorization, and then a whole bunch of things on Amy Beach. And you've done these all around the United States. And then last summer, you were in Australia.
That's correct.
Now, did you did anybody address your American accent there, or was that an issue at all?
A little bit. I mean, most people people recognized pretty quickly that I was not native to Australia.
Not a native to Australia. Okay, so we know that you're not native to Australia. Right. That's one of the things that we talk about your journey. So you've done a lot of things in your musical journey in the past, many years now. I wanted to start with that today to kind of get a sense, everyone to get a sense of where you are in your career at this point. You're working on getting tenure at UTSA, we're going to go way back. There was a time in your life, a time in your life journey, where you were not a pianist, you know. And I'm curious to when did you actually start, and what was that like?
I was in third grade, 8 years old.
Okay.
And I remember my older sister was basically teaching herself to play at our grandmother's house. And my dad was an amateur trumpet player.
Okay.
And kind of saw that she had some talent in kind of learning herself and decided to put her in lessons. And I think just being the younger brother, having to do whatever my sister did, decided that I was going to take lessons as well.
Okay. So how old was your sister when she started then?
She would have been, 12.
Okay. So 12. Mm-hmm. All right. Yeah. And then you started, you admired what she was doing and you wanted to follow along.
That's great.
And do you remember, how did you find your first teacher? You might not know this because you're eight, you know.
We grew up in a small town in northern Iowa and had one piano teacher in our town. And ironically, the way that the ages and everything worked out, I had actually taught my grandmother.
What a legacy.
I was just a few years older, 20 years older than my grandmother at the time.
Wow. So your grandmother studied with the same teacher in Iowa, and so you weren't facing some of the challenges people face in a larger city with finding the best teacher in town. That was the best teacher in town, clearly. Yep. Oh, amazing. So what kind of personality did the teacher have?
I guess at that age, I remember her being somewhat like a grandmother figure.
Okay.
But she was kind but also firm. Had some pretty high expectations. I think was well trained herself.
Yeah.
A member of MTNA.
Oh, okay, great.
I got to participate in a lot of those activities
early on. So of course you start piano lessons, and generally when you start, you don't maybe know what's in store for you. Mm-hmm. And you mentioned that she was a member of MTNA, which is very critical. So she sounds like she got you involved in a lot of activities. Mm-hmm. And at some point, I'm guessing you probably got where I'm doing this. This is more than just fun to be in the lesson, right? The lesson was fun, but probably something else, where the music itself started to kind of take over for you. Do you remember that happening? And if so, what was that like?
I mean, I remember, obviously participating in recitals and theory tests and duet festivals and things like that. So I think it just sort of started to become part of just my daily activity in life and things like that. I was never really the kind of child that my parents had to force me to practice.
Okay.
So I just remember going to the instrument a lot to just play for my own enjoyment. I can remember showing up to lessons, having learned additional pieces that I wasn't assigned.
Wow. You were like a dream student in the sense that you were doing it. Well, I mean, let's talk about what that means in a sense too. That basically means that you were in a fertile situation with a great teacher, someone you related to, someone you respected, someone who made it fun but was also firm, that writing that. And you also had an inclination and were doing it for yourself as well, which makes you do things like learn extra pieces and bring them in, yeah. Right? And embrace things like all the activities in MTNA. And I'm sure that also informed in a way your trajectory and your journey. I'll share with you briefly that I was fortunate that my very first teacher also was very involved in MTNA things. And so I thought everybody was,
right.
And that's not the case. You know, it's very fortunate for both of us that our first teacher was like that. So, okay. So you're in school. Now, what did you study with this teacher all the way through high school?
No, we actually moved to Mason City, Iowa, which is just 10 or 15 minutes south, my freshman year of high school.
Okay.
So I got on a waiting list with a teacher, and so I had a different teacher for a first year. Her name is Carrie Redderath. But then got on the waiting list and got into the studio for her name was Kathy Alcock.
Okay.
And studied with her for the rest of high school.
And wait, we should also mention the name of the first teacher you had.
First teacher was Marie Barda.
Marie Barda. Okay, fantastic. And then, okay, and so you were, when you first, so you mentioned a waiting list. So this sounds like this was someone that, the reason I like to track this is like, many people out there are also on their journey. Like, how do I find a great teacher? How do I identify a great teacher? One of the ways you can identify them is if they don't have room, right. and which can be frustrating because then they don't have room for you. But so how did you, one, know about these two teachers in Mason City? And then how did you, identify them and then contact them? And again, a lot of this was probably work done by your parents, but I'm guessing you had some say.
The first teacher, Carrie Redderath, I think was a recommendation from a music store.
Okay.
As far as Kathy, another classmate of mine in an upper grade was studying with her and was writing her own music. And I remember that student was really successful and I thought, really great pianist.
Yeah.
And so I thought, well, I want to study with the same teacher.
Yes.
And so just, figured out who that was and started that process and just had to wait a year.
Okay. So that's good. So you heard some proof in the real world of the results the teacher was getting. And then, you were like, well, who does that person work with? And that is a great way to do it.
Right.
And then what was it like then with those two teachers? Particularly, I guess the one that you went to before you went into college, like what were you doing like typically?
Kathy was a little bit different from my very first teacher in the sense that we had our studio recitals twice a year, but less on the MTNA activities.
Okay.
And she was really more focused on fostering just a love of music in her students. And I think cared more about their longevity as far as being interested in classical music, whether they chose to pursue it as a profession or not. And so I mean, she was the first person that probably introduced me to like standard classical literature at an advanced level.
Right.
And, famous pianists and their recordings. And I just sort of got enamored, I guess, at the time with classical literature.
Oh, that's a big deal. That's a very big deal. And then, this was the first person, the first year, your freshman year, or the...
This is Kathy, who I went to sophomore year.
Okay. And then at some point in there, I imagine you were like, well, I'm going to go to college, and what am I going to do? Like, you did get your bachelor's in piano performance. So how did you make that decision to go into that?
Yeah, I have kind of an interesting backstory.
Please, this is what we're here for. I want to hear about this.
So I did 2 years at community college in my hometown. And so I was still taking piano lessons with William Backlund for the first 2 years. I also played saxophone.
I should mention
my high school band director
as an influential teacher.
We can talk about that, I guess, in a minute. But I was actually all over the place as far as what I was doing in college, and ended up double majoring in piano performance and interdepartmental health sciences.
Okay.
It was biology for a while, but then went to that because I thought I was going to go to medical school.
Mm-hmm. Awesome. Well, you became a doctor anyway.
A different kind of doctor.
Actually. So let's back up into this band director, because mm-hmm. this is part of what I think is so important is that people need to recognize, if they know that, you know, we're on our journeys and we have people that influence us, our guides, right? And it's, I think, important to talk about that a little bit. Right. So this person, Mr. Backlund, is that was his name?
Sorry, that was who I took piano lessons with. Yeah,
I'm sorry, community college. And, then, yeah. And who was your band director?
My band director was Russ Kramer.
Okay, mm-hmm. And you mentioned that he was influential.
Yeah, I mean, I was very serious about the saxophone mm-hmm. all through high school. I actually mm-hmm. played it all through undergrad, okay. thought about majoring in saxophone performance. And as a director, I feel like not only taught his students music, but taught us a lot about life. And where I felt I learned more about being just a good human and responsible and having integrity in the work that I was doing. And even when I later transferred to the University of Iowa, came back and had a conversation with him when I was trying to decide if I was going to pursue music professionally. Mm-hmm. And so he has been very influential. We're still in contact. And
that's so cool. Yeah. We've had some conversations already on our show, and band directors have played that role for several people. Life skills and really, you know, that outside perspective beyond your parents,
right.
You know, that can be so critical. And obviously, I'm so glad you mentioned that. So you're at community college and you get finished and then, okay, you have to make another decision, right? So how was that decision made?
Well, I couldn't imagine stopping studying the piano at that point. And I knew I wanted to go to the University of Iowa because that's where the medical school was in the state. The only way to continue taking piano lessons through the university there at the time was to be a music major.
Okay.
And so I had a conversation with Mr. Backlund at the community college, and we started to just prepare an audition and sort of like see what happens kind of.
Right. Thing. Sure.
And so I auditioned and was accepted. And
that's awesome.
Yeah. Continued in that.
Okay. So then you were there for 2 years then?
I was actually there for three. It took a little bit longer to finish degrees.
Yeah. Oh, right. Of course. Mm-hmm. So you had 2 degrees. And what was it that, so then you had to eventually decide to not pursue the second degree. So for your master's program, what was that? How was that decision made?
Yeah. So my teacher in undergrad, Dr. Rainey Laquana, was really probably the first person that really talked to me about a career in higher education and actually the first person that I think mentioned any sort of potential about me continuing in music professionally. I think probably the fourth year of undergrad in total and when she said to me, you know, if this is something you're interested in, I really think you could pursue graduate work as a performance major. And
fantastic. How did you feel about that when she said that?
It was, I guess, exciting, validating, and caused me to think a lot about the next decisions that I was going to make. And nice that somebody, I think, saw that. Maybe others would have prior to that, but I just didn't express an interest maybe.
I'm curious, I forgot to ask one other thing about saxophone. Were you doing jazz as well as classical? With the saxophone?
I did some jazz in high school. I was, you know, first saxophone in our jazz band. But I mean, that was pretty the extent of my jazz.
Okay. So you found more resonance with the classical study overall.
Yeah.
And then, okay, so then your time to do your master's degree, and I'm making this very simple. We're going through this fast. Okay. Of course, the hours of practicing, we're leaving all that part out. How did you decide, you know, where to audition and then ultimately where to study?
I auditioned at a lot of schools in the Midwest, places that were fairly close to home. My undergrad teacher recommended Joel Shane Halls, who's at Eastern Michigan University. And they studied with the same teacher, Rebecca Penny, at Eastman for their doctorate.
Okay.
So she felt that it would be a nice transition for me to continue kind of in a similar line of thinking.
Right. Mm-hmm. Okay. And so, you went up there. What was it like working on your master's?
I was fortunate in a way, you know, I went from Iowa, which had master's and doctoral programs. Mm-hmm. And so there was basically a little fish in a big pond in that kind of situation.
In Mason City,
And then at Eastern Michigan, it was a smaller program, mm-hmm. just a master's degree. Mm-hmm. They didn't have doctoral okay. students. And also, I had a really strong foundation academically mm-hmm. For my undergrad. And so I felt that I just had a ton more practice time in my master's degree.
Okay.
To well, really focus on yeah. just playing the instrument. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Because, you know, the academics came fairly easy mm-hmm. to me, mm-hmm. I would mm-hmm. say.
So. Right, right. And then, so you then at some point decide, because you could have stopped at mm-hmm. your master's mm-hmm. degree, to continue study. What led to the decision to get a doctorate?
Ironically, a friend of mine from my undergrad, who was a doctoral student, had mentioned, Ivan, you're going on to get your master's degree. If you think you're at all interested in getting mm-hmm. a doctorate, you need to decide that from day one okay. of your master's degree.
Ooh, that's very good advice.
It flies by just okay. in a short 2 years.
Right.
And so I thought, if I'm going to try to have, I thought it was the most stable career option mm-hmm. was to pursue higher education. Mm-hmm. And so I went to Dr. Shane Halls and basically on the first day told him that.
Okay.
And so picked a program mm-hmm. and decided what repertoire would work well for auditions because mm-hmm. it's only about a year after that you
right,
start
that's
auditioning.
True. It is way yeah. faster than people think.
Yeah.
Okay. So then did you, in terms of then deciding on where to go to get your doctorate, mm-hmm. I mean, I know where you got your doctorate, but how did you come to that decision and also to add the pedagogy
right.
element?
Yeah, because both my bachelor's and master's were in performance. Mm-hmm. And as I started looking for doctoral programs at different universities across the country, I started to see a trend that there were a lot of people that were teaching pedagogy, mm-hmm. and in particular, graduates from the University of Oklahoma.
Okay, yes.
And so that's how I discovered that program. Mm-hmm. But then I started looking more into other pedagogy programs, and I did audition to some performance degrees as well, mm-hmm. or some that were combined, performance mm-hmm. and pedagogy. Mm-hmm. And I just sort of felt that where I was at that time, that I would have a greater success in mm-hmm. higher education in pedagogy than I would in performance. Mm-hmm.
Okay. Yeah. And then to choose to go to Oklahoma then, mm-hmm. like how did you, make that decision? What mm-hmm. was the process like?
I mean, I'm very lucky to have gone there. It's a selective mm-hmm. program.
Right.
It was my dream school. I didn't think I would get in. I yeah. was shocked to be uh-huh. accepted. Uh-huh. And so after I was accepted, I was in conversation with my teacher, Jane McGraw, mm-hmm. and she had invited me to join her studio. I remember visiting campus and feeling like that was the place that I was mm-hmm. supposed to be. Mm-hmm. It's just a magical place,
right?
When you're visiting for
yes,
the first time.
Yes, yes. Yeah. I've been fortunate enough to visit there. Just for those that don't know, so Dr. McGraw and also Barbara Fast, Jane McGraw and Barbara Fast, they're both there, are like legends, like legends in piano pedagogy, and they've had many legends graduate from the program. So I completely understand about that being your dream school, and right. and you know, it can be very weird in some ways to actually be having a conversation with someone who's that legendary, mm-hmm. and they're also incredibly nice people, mm-hmm. And they're just very warm and very gracious, and so you can sit and have a conversation, and you're like, what am I doing?
Right.
Part of your mind yeah. is thinking that, and so what it must have felt amazingly good then to mm-hmm. to get into the program, mm-hmm. and I've yeah. been to the campus there, and it is a beautiful, beautiful mm-hmm. campus, so in a nice sized town, I mm-hmm. think yeah. For college, so you were probably yeah you're very excited. So what was it like then to go through the program, mm-hmm. and how long were you there?
It's in a very immersive program. Mm-hmm. The assistantship includes, both teaching group piano mm-hmm. and applied piano. So I had the mm-hmm. opportunity to teach music minors and mm-hmm. Other students who were playing at higher levels. Mm-hmm. And there's just so many different opportunities that are presented to you as far as teaching master classes mm-hmm. to students in the local area. Or participating at the national level because mm-hmm. they have a very strong student collegiate chapter through
right.
MTNA.
Mm-hmm.
So there were just a lot of opportunities. And then also, it's a big, robust program.
Yeah.
And so there's very like-minded students that are mm-hmm. there mm-hmm. That are all kind of working towards the same goal. So it was just a really good environment to be a part of.
Awesome. Well, then, of course, you know, so then you actually get finished with the doctorate, which is not a simple task. And now one is facing the workforce. And that was one of the, I saw that was one of the presentations you've done is on what that's like. So your next journey, stop on the journey is not finding a place to teach. And you ended up at UTSA, which is now the School of Music. But what was that experience like? Okay, you're finishing or you're about to be finished. You're probably starting to look. And what was that experience like?
I mean, I had finished my third year on campus. All of my coursework was done. All I had left at that point was we did four doctoral workshops and then also writing a document. And so at that point, I was able to start looking for jobs. I had interviewed at University of Tennessee and Columbus State University in Georgia. And then the position here at UTSA was open that summer, kind of late in the job search time of the year. And remember having a few phone conversations with Cassandra Keeling, who was the interviewing me, and got the job and moved down.
So, amazing. Well, that sounds, you make it sound super simple.
It's not. I mean, I had another position lined up in Norman at one of their local smaller liberal arts colleges, teaching adjunct. And I had a pre-collegiate studio and a church job. And
You had all those bases covered.
Yeah, exactly. So if this didn't pan out, you know, I had something else in the back.
Of course. But I mean, it's very challenging. I mean, there are not that many positions that will that are open. And then there'll be, you know, 100 people, I mean, typically. I mean, so maybe even more than I've certainly heard more than 100 for these positions. So it's very, very challenging. And also, even the interview process itself, I know is very challenging. So it's so congratulations on that. So the thing is then that transitions well into the next part of the discussion, which is again, so if we go back, so you're eight and then, you know, you switch to all these, you know, the teachers, you move to Mason City, you find your love for classical music. You're still questioning what you might do. You go to community college, have some good guidance there. You have the band director, also a great lifelong guide to you. And then you end up, you know, you do your master's, but you have very good advice from someone who says from the first day, be sure that you're thinking of your doctoral program, what you want to be doing. You get your dream school. And of course, they well prepare you for those, then the job search. And then you get this job, and then you start working on tenure, which is also challenging now. Nowadays, it's the tenure positions are not as, I mean, they were never like, you know, there were never a lot of them, but now it's even harder. So so you're now in what year of your tenure process?
This is my 10th year at UTSA. It started as a lecturer position and then transitioned to tenure track in 2019. And so I'll be submitting my tenure file next fall.
Okay. So I think it'd be interesting for people to know. I mean, a lot of times they see people in a position like at a university. They get this job. And again, they don't know the background of how that happened. And they know about tenure, but they don't necessarily know what it takes to get tenure and how challenging that is. And then beyond that, there's then the full professor and all that kind of stuff too. So could you share a little bit what this has been like, this experience with working on your tenure file?
It's definitely a balancing act and wearing many different hats. a typical job is split 40% teaching, 40% research and creative activity, and then 20% service. So there's a lot of different activities that one has to do that kind of go into that overall file. And it's also you have to continue to produce that work over the course of 6 or 7 years. And I think just seeking out pretty much any opportunity and trying to capitalize on those opportunities when you can. And so I think there's just a lot of different moving parts.
So because you're about, and that's part of what, when I earlier read through your activities, all those I think fit into that balance, the publications as well as the workshops, master classes, recitals, all of that stuff. But as you said, part of the challenge there is to keep that going over a lengthy period of time, a significant period of time. So how do you balance all that just time wise? How do you, I mean, how does that time management wise work?
Right. I think I've worked out my schedule in such a way that I'm mostly teaching in the middle part of the week. Mm-hmm. And then I reserve Monday and Fridays for the time that I'm spending on my creative projects.
Okay. Okay.
And I think just being involved in the different professional organizations helps because then you realize what kind of opportunities are available and the types of things that other people in your field are doing that whether they have tenure or working towards tenure as examples.
Right. So, yeah, because you're plugged into like NCKP and, right. and then MTNA certainly. Mm-hmm. What advice would you have for someone who's day one of their master's program and might be thinking, I want to work towards a tenure track position?
Right.
What do you have? I mean, any thoughts what you would tell
There's them? Lots of opportunities for college students to get involved. I presented at my first national conference as a collegiate student in my undergrad through a collegiate chapter.
Amazing.
Yeah. And then I guess, you know, for my students at UTSA, I try to provide them with similar opportunities. Mm-hmm. And so MTNA has the collegiate symposium. Our students That's are presented true. At that. Right. Mm-hmm. A student recently won a collegiate writing contest, they'll be published before their.
Oh, congratulations! That's amazing.
Job force as a student.
Yeah, it's a big deal.
And I think just starting to participate professionally is the best way to start getting involved early on, so that you can start to make connections and get to know faculty across the country and other students who are likely going to be your colleagues as they're in similar positions and things like that.
I think sometimes they're not the students are until they start getting involved, they don't realize that it's quite a small world, this musical world. And once you do lean in, then it becomes a little bit more clear, all these opportunities. What other questions? Because I don't have tenure myself, right? I didn't do this. So what are some questions that I might be missing to ask you about this process?
I think that, you know, it just goes beyond the creative and research work. Mm-hmm. The teaching, especially at UTSA, and our population of students is very heavily regarded. So we have to be good educators.
Well, that's true.
And so I think thinking about ways that you can create opportunities for college students is an important part of a tenure track position, and also getting your students recognition, whether that be at the college level or outside of the university. And then the other piece of it is the kinds of things that go into the service portion. It happens at all sorts of different levels.
You mean like in terms of local, national?
Correct.
That kind of stuff.
Yeah.
One thing I also wanted to mention, I think it's kind of unusual. A lot of times those in a pedagogy, they're running a pedagogy program, will not do as much private teaching as you're doing. And you're doing a lot of private teaching on top of all this. That stresses you out even more in some ways in terms of time. I'm very grateful because we're grateful to have you here at Maxa. I mean, you contribute a tremendous amount. Yet some people don't do that. And that's fine. They have their reasons for that. But can you speak a little bit about why you feel that that's important for you?
It definitely makes it more challenging to balance everything. But as a pedagogy professor where I'm teaching undergrad and graduate students to be teachers, I feel that if I'm also teaching students that are of all ages, really, that it makes the content that I'm delivering in class more relevant. I'm not just talking about an ideal student that exists on paper.
Right.
And I can share with them experiences of all sorts of different success stories and challenges with students and parental interactions and how to prepare them for different types of activities. I mean, so it's like real hands-on experience that I'm gaining that I can then impart on my college students.
I think that's very valuable. I think that's from my experience too. It's having someone who can, because the parents and the students are not always reacting, like you said, the way that they should, right? And then you have to still figure out a way to make it all work.
Right.
In terms of the direction that you think future-wise, in terms of piano pedagogy, What trends are you seeing, you know, in our world?
Yes, I think we're all working to be more inclusive and more diverse. So I know at the conferences that I'm attending, I'm seeing a lot more emphasis in those areas, kind of getting out of the standard canon of literature, for example, but also a heavy emphasis on technology and how that relates to music education. So those are some of the trends that are, I think, are emerging. Also, you know, working with Gen Z students and how to motivate them. And, you know, because the population of student is changing along with the times of the world, you know. And so we have to be prepared as to how we're going to help continue classical education or just piano study in general.
Awesome. And then what about for yourself? Like, I know you've got one more year left on the tenure file, and I'm guessing you have to still do things. Is there anything that you have coming up that's particularly exciting for you?
So the National Conference on Keyboard Pedagogy is a biannual conference, and so we have one coming up in 2025. I'm serving on the National Planning Committee for that.
Oh, great. Fantastic.
So I'll be helping to organize the conference. But also I submitted some proposals myself, and one of them is with three other colleagues of mine at different universities and exploring general pedagogy for all instrumentalists and how we can sort of impart what the field of piano pedagogy has done into other instrumental areas. But so that's a couple projects on the forefront. I was recently invited to be the guest clinician for West Texas A&M's teachers conference
in
March.
Okay, fun.
2025. Yeah. So that's an exciting opportunity coming up.
That sounds amazing. Yeah, I working on the NCKP National Planning Committee, that I found my first time attending in person was the last one, and it was fantastic. It was fantastic, and a real forward thinking, leaning energy to it. You know, I feel that people are going to still be playing the piano in 200 years, and we have to adapt, and we have to. And I think part of the reason it's been successful recently in the past 10 or so years is because of all this pedagogical effort, really. You know, you see a lot of differences now, and a lot of training and ways of approaching things that I didn't see when I was first learning. So it's pretty amazing, and you're a big part of that. So that's pretty exciting to do. So, thank you so much for speaking with us today. I'm so excited. I'd love to at some point have you share with us some more stuff on your specific projects. I mean, on all these different things that you have. But thank you for joining us, and I want to also thank you for being with us for another episode of Journeys of Max, a podcast. Thank you so much for being here.
Thank you.